In this episode of Tim Talk, we discuss stigmas around diseases.
Welcome to Tim Talk, where our mission each day is to explore issues of social and medical justice, and through meaningful dialogue, find a better path forward. I am Tim Dentry, CEO of Northern Light Health. Our guest today is someone I'm very excited to have on our show because he has been championing medical justice on a national scale for decades. Dr. Sohail Rana is a professor of pediatrics at Howard University and conference director for the International Conference on Stigma and the Roland B. Scott Symposium. He is board certified in pediatrics and pediatric hematology. Along with his pediatric hematology research team, he has been providing care to children and young adults with HIV and sickle cell disease for more than 30 years in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. He ran the Pediatric and Perinatal AIDS Clinical Trials Unit at Howard University from 1992 to 2016. He conducts many other HIV-related and sickle cell disease-related projects. Since 2009, he has passionately led the Howard University Stigma Project to battle health-related stigma and discrimination. That's what we want to get to the heart of today. Dr. Sohail Rana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tim, for having me here. I again thank God for this opportunity, and I thank you all and your wonderful team for all the great work you've been doing in this area of social justice in healthcare. God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know when I am in the midst of rock stars. Dr. Rana, you shared with me when we spoke earlier the long journey of your incredible career, beginning with early work with HIV and sickle cell patients, and the overlap you saw with mental illness. That's very, very interesting. Could you share with our listeners your perspective on what patients experienced and how that affected them, be it physically, emotionally, or spiritually? And then a later question will shift to how it affected you and how you then broaden that from that perspective, gain so much wisdom on stigma and to do something about that. But let's maybe start with what your patients taught you in your early days.
You know, Tim, I saw my first child with HIV in 1985. And from then on, you know, the number just kept increasing. I was a pediatric hematologist. I got involved in the first child because that child had problems with blood counts. And I had done a bone marrow, and subsequently that child was diagnosed with HIV. And as more and more patients came, I was just astounded, you know, how they clung to me. And it was just amazing. I had to give very little love, and they tripled it, quadrupled it, and 10 times, and they just didn't want to go anywhere else. And then as I started questioning them, you know, there were also some deaths, and I would show up at the funeral, and I'll see nobody knew about child's diagnosis. Sometimes the grandmother didn't know, the older sister didn't know, the uncle didn't know, the pastor didn't know. And we were all shocked where these individuals who should be spending energy in pursuing life, pursuing other things, they were spending all their energy in hiding the diagnosis of HIV and what was going on. And, you know, I kept asking, and I could see in the look of the nurses in the intensive care nursery or other places, in the looks of the doctors, you know, how they looked down and how they talked about people with HIV. And each time it broke my heart, because most of these mothers I knew, you know, very few people know that people, mothers who had HIV infection and whose kids got infected, many of them, or I would say 95% of them, were sexually abused as children. And they grew up hooked to drugs, hooked to crack, and they were exchanging drugs for sex to fulfill their habit. And they were so loving, so loving. I remember a mother, I said, she wasn't coming to the clinic, and I said, so and so, you know, you missed so many appointments. And she looked at me, she said, Dr. Rana, you know, the day I cannot come is because I'm babysitting. And I said, you babysit, so you must be doing all right. She said, Dr. Rana, no. These are mothers who are getting their first interview. And sometimes they have $5 to give me and sometimes not. But this is my way of giving back to community what I have gotten from others. So I babysit the children so that this mother can go for an interview or something. And I looked at her and with tears in my eyes, to me, she was the real hero. Now, I just want to take us back that this was 1997. And I didn't understand much, to be honest, about what was happening with HIV and why all this effort to hide the diagnosis and what all the fuss was about. Because I carried these children around. They slobbered on me. I wasn't worried. And I would draw their blood many times without gloves because I was used to. And I was sitting on Sunday, and there was this big write-up about the Hansen House in Carville, Louisiana, this was 1997 December, and Bill Clinton was closing this, and there were 135 patients with leprosy still there. So this Carville House was designed just to treat and keep, but many of the patients were actually incarcerated there. They couldn't go anywhere. So these patients, there were still 135 patients, and many of them were so scared because the only family they knew was in Carville House. And some of them were in their 70s and 80s. And the only people they knew were the other people with Carville. And there was an interview of a young lady I'll call Betty. She was 70 some years of age. And they had interviewed, Washington Post had interviewed her. And she was saying, you know, I still remember I was 9 years old and I was in school. And my dad in his big car came with a chauffeur, and I sat in the back, and my father hardly looked at me, and we went to the doctor. I had this patch on the skin. We went to the doctor. All I remember was not the words, but the doctor nodding at my father. And then we drove and came to this place. My father never looked at me. I went to the door. A lady received me. I entered, and that was the last time I saw my family. And I was 9 years of age. And the only family I have are the people living here. And in the Carville House, if you look at the pictures, there are so many graves there of people living who lived with leprosy and died of leprosy or of other causes. And they have no names. Many a time they have just numbers because their family didn't want them, their name to be attached to leprosy. And I just began to understand stigma. And then I had we were conducting all these clinical trials, and I had these young children, and we were finding new drugs, and, you know, they were showing promise. And I remember a girl named Chelsea. She was very close to me. Every time she called, you know, she looked at me, she would call me dad with like a 3 D's attached at the end. She wanted to be a comedian, and she would tell joke after Dr. Rana. She said, Dad, you rock, just like you said. And my wife would send her presents and this and that. And she stopped taking her medication. I couldn't figure out why, because her viral load was well closed. And one day I confronted her. I said, Chelsea, what's going on? And she cried, and she said, Dr. Rana, my family has been mistreating me since they found out about my HIV. Every time I sit down, they clean the seat with Clorox. They keep my dishes separate. But I didn't care for that. You know, they don't wash my clothes with their clothes. I didn't care for that. I have just one friend, and that was my cousin. And I finally got the courage to tell my cousin about my HIV. And she was so supportive. She listened to me and she said, you know, things are changing. You're going to be all right. The medications are coming. You're going to be fine. And she said, oh, here is somebody who listened to me. And I got up and I tried to hug her. And she moved away. And she says, that broke my heart. She says, nobody is ever going to love me. And she stopped taking her medication. And a few months later, she died. She didn't die of HIV. She died of stigma of HIV. She could have lived a normal life. Lovely, lovely, wonderful. I have picture of her in my office. I have picture of her friends. And, you know, I actually have her picture in my wallet, too, because she was very close to my family and my wife, too. And at 17, 18 years of age, that girl, she just totally refused for only one reason. She said, nobody would ever love me. Why should I live? Why should I live? So I began to learn about stigma. And I, you know, every facet, every person I talked to, I couldn't believe there, you know, we may have 50 domains, 40 domains, 30 domains. Every facet of these people's life was affected with stigma. That was preventing them from living a normal life. So that was my beginning education with stigma, Tim.
Yes. You know, I was going to ask you, over time, being witness and caregiver to so many struggling and suffering individuals, but I just need to pause right there mid-sentence, because the way you described it, I could feel it. I could see those individuals you're talking about. I could feel your passion and your love and your heartbrokenness. And to me, that, again, that just shows you the unique character, the unique individual that we're speaking with today, Dr. Rana, because you're bringing so much to this dialogue, this discussion that we're having today. But finishing my thought for you to, I'm looking at it as how you gained wisdom of the stigma that surrounds those carrying these diseases. All these stories, just like listeners right now, I'm looking at Dr. Rana's office that he has at Howard University Hospital, and he has a collage of individual pictures, just like the ones I'm sure that he just shared with you, including in his own wallet. And each one of those has a story, and there are probably so many others that you have in your mind and heart and soul and the impact. So it's just very moving. This is a very moving discussion to me. And with stigma, it's what I hear you say is it's not just a reactive response that you have, a visceral response, but you also gained a lot of wisdom. And that's what we want to delve into right now, I think, is I think it's also fascinating how you're spreading that wisdom, you're sharing that wisdom that surrounds those carrying these diseases. Can you help our listeners? I'm finally getting to a question, so thanks for bearing with me. Can you help our listeners understand more what stigma is and how it presents itself in not only the visible but the invisible ways? You gave some great examples, and you gave great examples of what I often love to quote, which is Maya Angelou, who says, people forget what you did, they'll forget what you said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. So stigma, invisible and visible.
Tim, I think a good definition of stigma is an attribute that would devalue that person in your mind. So suddenly that person doesn't have the same value again. So I give you one example that today somebody gets diagnosed with breast cancer or their child gets diagnosed with leukemia. You know, they put pictures on Facebook, hero, my hero, my hero. I need money for this. You know, donations are pouring in. And I can tell you one thing, that if somebody has HIV today, the first thing they want to do is to go bury themselves 30 feet down on the ground. They cannot tell anybody. So that is what our website for stigma conference is, www.whocanyoutell.org. You know, whocanyoutell.org. So it because you have internalized that thing that, you know, if you tell anybody, they will think you're nothing. You're nothing but trash. And I learned so many, you know, dirty words for what people use. And even my patients who were very open about their HIV, who who got on radio shows with me. Some people got after them, put on Facebook how, you know, this person is trashy, she has HIV. And this young lady who was so open, I couldn't believe. She said, oh, I'm hiding in North Carolina because one of my friends put all this trash on my Facebook page and now I cannot face anybody. So, you know, even people were open. People come to our conference and they're just, you know, sometimes they disclose, but then suddenly they're very scared. Oh, did my aunt, did my grand aunt watch this? Because, you know, she talks so terribly about people with HIV or about gays or lesbians. So it's an ever unfolding. It's all about hate. You know, it's all about devaluation. It's all about, you know, where you find reason to say, oh, I'm better than you. Yeah. You know, you talked about wisdom and there's no wisdom better than what the scriptures say. And this is one story that all religious beliefs share pretty much, that God asks Iblis is the name of Satan in Quran. I think its story is told many times, but at least 7 or 10 times, Satan is called Iblis, that bow down before Adam. And Iblis says, no, how can I bow down? I'm superior to him. You made him of dirty clay, but you made me of fire. So that story, to me, is the original sin. It keeps repeating itself over and over from toddler year. Oh, my dad is a policeman. Oh, my dad is this. Oh, my dad is a doctor. My dad is this. And your dad is not. Unless we confront it. And many children learn this bad habit. They learn to hate at home. And, you know, we saw example of that in South and other areas where you know, hate is taught. I don't think we are all, there are any exception. I think we all do relatively poor job of teaching people acceptance and tolerance and diversity and how people are all the same in the eyes of God, no matter what. And we don't teach enough that, look, you need to treat people like you want to be treated, which is a common behavioral thing taught in all religions. Do not say to others what you don't like to hear from others. Do not mistreat them because you will get mistreated the same way. Do not do injustice. And like I was telling you earlier, God says, I have forbidden myself to be unjust. So do not be unjust to others and do not oppress others. So stigma is one of the worst form of oppression because it makes people hide. It makes people not go to their doctor. Many people don't go to get screened for HIV because, you know, what if somebody find out? Even the testing, oh, maybe they will think I'm high risk. That's why I'm getting tested. So it's the same thing that plays out with many other. I remember this young lady, she's a friend of mine on Facebook, and she has sickle cell disease. And she beautiful. If you look at her picture, you would, you know, she could be easily Miss Uganda. And she said, Dr. Rana, my boyfriend took me to meet his mother. And she right on my face said, oh, you could do better than a sickler, you know? And she wanted to commit suicide. She said, who would ever love me because I have sickle cell disease? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was the same thing with blindness. It was the same thing with leprosy. And story keep repeating. We're finding reasons to put down some people. And certainly there are financial benefits to that. You talk about addiction, jailing people with addiction. There are definite financial advantages to certain segments of society by jailing others, by mistreating them, by pushing them down. So I think there are those gains, but basically it's ignorance. Basically it is fear. It is blame. that you are responsible for your own poverty. You are responsible for this disease. You did it to yourself, so we shouldn't have to pay for you. You don't belong with us.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Rana, you're striking so many chords that are familiar themes that we share in what we call our culture of caring. We have a family of 13,000 or so staff, and then their families. So we have a very large footprint of citizens that are in Maine right now, and we have a culture of caring, and it starts with caring for one another. But as I shared with you, you know, my healthcare roots in my family, you know, we were taught that healthcare workers especially have a higher calling and have a higher demand on us to make sure that we are tuned into any possibilities of presenting anything that would worsen a person's mental state or physical state. Obviously, first do no harm, right? And so what you're really pointing out, I hope that our listeners listen to this once and listen to this twice and then think about that. And everyone should look at the way that as they live their lives and practice their profession, whatever that profession might be in our big healthcare family here, and how can we make sure that we are doing everything we can personally to have people feel good about themselves and not use a very painful and hurtful and awful tool to bring someone harm. And so I wonder, you really caught my imagination on what another thing we could share with the listeners a little more deeply on the www.whocanyoutell.org, but how that's related to your international conference on stigma that's coming up in November. So I wonder if you just, you know, share a little time with us on what's that conference about and who comes and what are the messages and what are some of the takeaways?
I think the biggest issue was raising awareness. And I take a little bit of pride in this that, you know, when we start doing this conference, to be honest, it was so frustrating that, you know, we were like ringing, what can we do? What can we do to help our children? Because all these patients, you know, they were, whether they called me dad or not, you know, many of them had lost their parents. So we were parents too. So I have a wonderful, wonderful, very loving team. I mean, I can't say enough. I like mentioned many of my colleagues who work with me, Patty especially, and other, Cynthia, Sahil, they took some of our girls, got into college. They were the one taking them to set up their dorm rooms. It was just for their weddings, for their childbirth. We just recently had a young lady who we took care of since birth. She just had a baby and baby shower and getting her things for the baby. It was just amazing what my people do. So I love what I do, but I love my team. They have done an outstanding job. So I think the basic theme was that we need to educate what we are doing to the people. And I think our focus was primarily on healthcare industry, healthcare teams, and because, you know, for lack of better terms, pardon my French, that our attitude in healthcare, it sucked and it still sucketh. So, it's still, we did surveys in healthcare facilities and we found that almost 50-60% of the healthcare workers have negative attitudes toward people with HIV. And they don't think very highly of people with sickle cell disease either. So it was really, really terrible. So I think working with the community, but what we also found was that those people who got the training, they were doing much better and they were becoming very good advocates. So at the conference, number one, we have a bunch of researchers who've been in this area for 30, 40 years, working in different community, and it's the same. You know, talk about distant village in Nigeria, Caribbean, Pakistan, story is all the same. It's sad, you know. Stigma is bad. Stigma is everywhere. May take slightly different form, but it is horrible, and it impacts the patient. So making people aware of what they're doing, and unjustly, because patients cannot transmit HIV casually. People with sickle cell disease are not doing it to themselves. They are not drug addicts if they show up in emergency. You know, there was belief in healthcare system until recently, even now, that blacks do not feel the pain the same way as whites do. So it's disgusting, right? But the people, other kind of belief, and this is many minority physicians, I may make the patient addict because I'm treating pain acutely. So many problems in the area of sickle cell disease, and that stigma persists not even here in the African countries where everybody is black. They still discriminate against people with sickle cell disease and other genetic diseases. He's less idea of God punishing somebody with a genetic disease because their forefathers committed sin. Huh? So that's where faith community has done a terrible job, and they continue to not do too well. So yeah. I think our basic theme was to raise awareness and educate people and give platform to the researchers who were working in the field to broadcast their work widely, to recognize it, but also give opportunity to the patients to come and feel that, you know, they are not alone. What they are going through is not alone. All our conferences were webcast, watched all over the world, and this continued to. So we have a virtual component always where it gets webcast everywhere in the world, and then we have in-person community. I think we have done a decent job, but when we look at the reality of it, 35, 40 years later after HIV, so long after sickle cell disease becoming recognized and other genetic diseases, mental illness, addictions, obesity, mental health. And, you know, Tim, what is the biggest stigma all over the world? It's unbelievable. It is poverty. And that's the common denominator, even with these diseases, that these diseases make you poor and then increase. Also, race. Many of these diseases disproportionately affect poor people who are mostly marginalized, African American or people of minorities. So I think that cross-sectional stigma is important, but we keep raising voice, we keep raising awareness, and hope is to have a Center for Social Justice, to have a rapid response team, but to train people, interest people, graduate students in this area to find the main drivers and nip them in the bud, you know, very early. When a new infection comes, a new problem comes, you know, be the first responder, make noise. No, let's not let this become a stigmatized disease. You know, we need to stop it right here.
That's wonderful. You know, Suhail, I know that the listeners are beginning to say, that's something that I can do. So maybe let's go there for a second as my last question, and that is, what can our listeners, healthcare givers and all others that listen, but especially the healthcare givers and, you know, the culture of the family of those of Northern Light Health in particular, but all others that are listening, what can we do individually to bring awareness and help expose and correct stigma?
Excellent question. Thank you for asking. I think the first thing is to look at the man in the mirror. You know, I got to look in man in the mirror, and you know, I make so many mistakes, even despite knowing all that and preaching. You know, we make the same kind of mistake. So self reflection. I think it's so good. There's a concept of cultural humility that every physician needs to learn. Cultural humility. And it goes beyond cultural competence. It goes way beyond. It's not enough. You know, cultural competence has a good definition, but very few people really know it. You know, he says, oh, I'm dealing with an Arab. So I tell them, oh, I love hummus. So I know all about Middle East, right? So it goes way beyond. I think definition of cultural competence itself needs to be broadcast, that it is maximizing our commonalities and minimizing our differences. So that part is so critical. How we interact, especially with a sensitized population like HIV, sickle cell, who are already feeling afraid, who are sensitized, oh, this person is going to say something mean to me or going to ask me a difficult question. So becoming aware of those things, I think human touch, I think it's very, very big. When you went around and asked people what would make you feel more comfortable with your healthcare provider, you know, human touch, why do you need to put on gloves to examine the abdomen? You know, give the person a thorough exam with your bare hand. Not that you're going to find anything, but, you know, one of the things I do, I spend a great deal of time feeling the lymph nodes in the neck. I'm not going to find anything. But you see, this contact is telling them something. That's I'll take great. Care of you no
that
matter what.
Wonderful.
I'm here for you. I'm here for you. So use your hand. You know, that is all medicine is about. All your instrument, all those digital, all your computer stuff, that ain't going to do anything. That patient is begging to be touched. And, you know, sometimes just offering them, you know, can I get you something to eat? And I always have snacks in my office. So, you know, and whether I'm a Pakistani, you don't listen to no, you know. my children get irritated. You don't listen to no. Say, no, we ate breakfast. Now, but here, you know, this is really, these grapes are really good. You know, sharing food, man, that would raise your status. Be aware of your position. Don't look down on patient while you're talking to them. Get your hands out of your pocket. Get the gloves off unless you're really performing a procedure. You know, say things. Say things that would make them feel. You say, oh, look, you know, I'm on the spectrum for autism. You know, I felt like that. I'm ADHD. You know, my family has, you know, I know so many people in my family who have serious illnesses. And you hold their hands, make them feel that you're no superior to them. And that recognition that we have a power gradient over the patient all the time. And you need to work like Bill Clinton, put down your feet on the ground, let them sit high, touch their knees and say, how are you doing? Look them in the eyes. You know, let the love flow through your hands, through your word, through your eyes, and just you will change lives. You will make people want to live. Right now, many of those people with stigmatized illnesses, they don't want to live. So they don't want to go to doctor. You know, look at mental health, what happens. I have so many people in my family with mental illness. None of them wants to go to psychiatrist. None of them. They don't want their medications to be seen. You know, even when they're taking medication for depression and stuff. So we need to talk about it openly, normalize the discussion. These are just illnesses, you know. My children with HIV got it from their mother, and their mother got it through rape, you know. How can you look down on those people?
Yes. Sohail, I tell you, I could speak with you all day long. I consider us kindred spirits. Some of the things I just want to re-quote you, you know, look at the man in the mirror. That is so true. And cultural humility, and that's way beyond, you know, cultural competency for sure. Cultural humility, absolutely true. One thing that as I've grown older, I realize that humility is the greatest strength, whereas most see it at different stages of their life, but it's almost a weakness or it's a vulnerability. But yeah, and vulnerability, That is a strength. The other thing you said, I love what I do and I love my team. And that's me too here. You know, I love what I do and in my work and with all the other things, how I spend my time with family and others. But I love my team because my team, as I say all the time, especially over the pandemic, I started Suhail on April 1 of 2020 as CEO here. So of course that's, you know, the rest of the story. But I'm constantly, my sail is filled with the people that I work with who I love. So we're kindred spirits for sure. Do you have any last thoughts or last ideas that you wanted to make sure you share before we concluded this talk?
You know, I was just recognized just for my years of service at Harvard, and I'm not even going to tell it. They had very nice, beautiful trophy, and they said nice words. And I stood up, and there were CEOs and all these people sitting. And you know, I was chastising them about talk about money, and I stood up, and I, with my very horrible singing voice, I said, you know, I have a song for you. And I started singing, God prepare me to be a sanctuary. And the CEO joined me, and we all sang. And in healthcare, you know, patients seek us not for medicine. They know many a time there isn't a medicine that would cure them. They seek us as a sanctuary, you know, something that they can spill everything. They can tell, they can let you touch their private parts, you know, without shame. They can tell you the most shameful things about their life. And you know, that is such a privilege. But we need to work on ourselves to be a real sanctuary, for the sake of God, for the sake of justice, because we'll have to account. Anytime I look down on somebody, I have to go back and give account. You know, Prophet Muhammad in Quran, he's considered the most, the kindest, the gentlest, the true mercy for humanity. But he was chastised 4 times. 3 times for being too lenient. 1 time because a blind man came to him. This is chapter 80, Abbas Abatawalla. And he was trying to ask him a question, but Prophet was talking to these big celebrities, chieftains, and he frowned and he turned away. And God didn't let him get away with it. And remember, blindness was one of the biggest stigma. So remember the parable of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, when he was walking with the apostles and they saw a blind man coming and they asked, oh, apostle, is this man blind for his sins or his forefather's sins? And he picked up some earth, he put his spit, and he says, he's not blind for his sins or his forefather's sins. He's blind so that God could show his glory through his healing. And he heals the guy. Beautiful. And that's what we are called to do.
Dr. Suhail Rana, thank you so much. It is my privilege to have spent this time and to get to know you. I'm honored to have met you. And I know our listeners have benefited greatly from your wisdom and your stories and your heart and your spirit. You are so right that we all yearn, as you said to me previously today, we all yearn for the same thing, peace, safety, and especially, yes, dignity. Thank you for bringing light into the darkness for us today.
Thank you so much, Tim, for having me. God bless Pleasure. You and God bless your team. You guys do a wonderful job. Keep on trucking.
God bless you, your team, and all those that you serve. And thank you, our podcast listeners, too. Until next time, I'm Tim Dentry, encouraging you to listen and act to promote our culture of caring, diversity, and inclusion that starts with caring for one another. Thank you, Dr. Rana, once again. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Tim Talk. If you enjoyed this podcast, please join us next month when we have a conversation with Rabbi Sam Weiss, the new rabbi of Congregation Beth El in Bangor.